C7. Number 7A.
Now we take the next chapter on Atonement and Eucharist, and we can see quite clearly that this chapter just leads the thought one step further. Because you remember, in the chapter on prayer, we had that very important statement about oneness, that Jesus' prayers were deep and conscientious protests of truth, and then of man's likeness to God, and of man's unity with truth and love. And now Atonement says Atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God, whereby man reflects divine truth, life, and love. So, in prayer, we first have the conscientious protest of man's unity with God. Then, the moment that Christ comes in, we have here at the second chapter, the Word as the Christ, the moment that Christ comes in, that unity is being exemplified. So Atonement is the exemplification of that unity, of man's unity with God. And at once we get the sense of expression. Exemplification is naturally a manifestation of that unity, so that we have here a sense that by accepting in prayer man's unity with God, something is going to happen. Something is going to happen out of that unity. We are not going to make it happen. It happens by itself, so that the God-like is exemplified in man. If we consider this as a nice sequence, then we can really see that through that unity with God, God exemplifies itself in us, which also shows that the God unlike can no more be exemplified in us. It excludes that. Now we know, when we know the level of divine science, that on the level of divine science, the problem of evil is always handled in the following way, that it does not say how it overcomes evil or error, how it destroys error, but on the level of divine science is that consciousness where we see error is excluded, evil is excluded, not overcome. It's overcome in Christian science, but in divine science it is excluded. Therefore, we always can take into our spiritual mathematics the positive and the negative by seeing that when the God-like is exemplified, that means at the same time that the God-unlike is not exemplified, is no more exemplified, is excluded. So, the result of prayer we get in Atonement and Eucharist, the exemplification of it. Therefore, we can see that what Mrs. Eddy means here in this chapter, that she says that the Atonement of Christ reconciles man to God. It is always a sense of man's unity with God, from which we started out, man one with God, but now we can see that in the Atonement that oneness is established, and therefore a belief that one is not one, that something else is exemplified, is excluded. Therefore, we can summarize our sense of oneness by stating, perhaps we write that into our box in Atonement and Eucharist, man's oneness with God, man's oneness with God is exemplified as the God-like. As the God-like. All right. Now, what does this imply for us? Well, in divine science, the oneness, really, we should see that the human element does not enter. Therefore, there is no question here of how we reconcile ourselves with God. That would be on the level of Christian science, and therefore is a subject in the matrix of the structure of the textbook. Therefore, everything that whatever is demanded here is that we do not interfere, that we let the oneness to be the oneness. Therefore, it demands for us the willingness, so to say, to let God happen, that's all. That we do not interfere with it, the willingness not to resist what is happening in this exemplification. Really, the willingness to put everything out of the way, to put ourselves out of the way, to put Mary out of the way, as Mrs. Eddy would call it, when she was saying how she was healing a case instantaneously. She said, I put Mary out of the way, showing that this oneness demands that we let it happen, and we do not in any way somehow try to make it happen. This exemplification, as Jesus exemplifying the unity of God, of man and God, is shown actually in that relationship between Mary and Jesus, where Mrs. Eddy would state it that Jesus was the offspring of what? Of Mary's self-conscious communion with God. Therefore, self-conscious communion with God is that unity of man and God. That was prayer. The unity of man and God, the oneness of man with God. And this is exemplified. It has an exemplification. And the exemplification was Jesus as the offspring. Having seen this sense of dualism, we can ask ourselves oneness. Huh? We have seen this kind of this sense of oneness. Now we have to see the sense of dualism that is brought up in this chapter. We have seen in the chapter on prayer, we had a certain sense of dualism, namely, somebody who prays and he is not one with God, so that the one that prays is separate from the petitioned man, separate from God. And now we must see what is the opposite of that sense of oneness here in atonement, and we see that there are theology can bring up a wrong sense of oneness, namely that it certainly tries to atone opposites. She says even Christ cannot reconcile truth to error. In religion, this is a great drive in the human mind, that it would like to reconcile truth and error, that it would reconcile that something that is wrong is considered to be right, that something that is wrong is considered no more as wrong, and that it is not a factor, but that everything afterwards is all right again. So this would be a wrong sense of of oneness, or another kind of dualism that enters in is that there is no atonement of God and men. There is no reconciliation of God to men. God does not reconcile himself with men. Only man can reconcile himself with God, but not the other way around. God never reconciles with men. God never atones with men. That would be a wrong sense of oneness again that is brought up in this chapter. We see it has all to do with how to reconcile, how to exemplify the oneness. Or another phase of dualism that she shows here is that there is vicarious atonement, that Jesus atoned for us, that our atonement with God is brought about through a third party, namely through Jesus and through Jesus' deeds. So that through Jesus' deeds, through another's goodness and suffering, as she says, and through another's triumph, we are reconciled. So again, there is a false sense of reconciliation. Still another way, you see, there are quite a few wrong concepts of oneness, that she says man cannot atone for himself. Man cannot, out of his own volition, out of his own efforts, atone for himself. She says we cannot choose for ourselves, but must work out our salvation in the way Jesus taught. We cannot define our way of salvation, so that we have to see that the power of exemplification, the power of exemplifying the unity of man and God is in the Christ, is in the workings of God. It is here where we see that the Son can do nothing out of himself. It is the Father in me that doeth the works. It is God that works in me to do and to fulfill the works. So, in this way, we get quite a few aspects of dualism. How shall we put that and epitomize it in our matrix? Perhaps we put it this way and say, mortals try to atone out of their own power. Mortals try to atone out of their own power. Yes? Now, let's think a bit further in this line. We can't help but feeling that the moment we leave the chapter prayer and that we come into the chapter of Atonement and Eucharist, that we feel a tremendous power always in operation. Namely, the Christ power in operation. The exemplifying power in operation. In prayer, the statement was only to say that with God all things are possible. But it was only a statement that with God all things are possible. So it was only stated that with God there is all the power invested there with which something can be exemplified. But when we come to Atonement and Eucharist, you really get that operation of it, because there she says the design of love is to reform the sinner, and that God is the power in the messianic work. So this tone is a very key tone in this whole chapter, that God is the power in the messianic work, meaning that the power for salvation is not in the mortal, in the human, but that that power of the messianic work lies in God. But what means God? At that point it means God means that there is a chapter on prayer that precedes it, and that chapter on prayer said, man is one with God. That's the power. If first we don't see our oneness with God, then we don't experience the working power of God. It is only when we are one with God that God's power is felt within us, or we are separating us from God, we are separating us from the Christ power, and therefore we are not going with the Christ power, and therefore we cannot experience in a harmonious way the reconciling power of the Christ. Another way how in this chapter Mrs. Eddy would pinpoint this exemplifying power is that she says the divine must overcome the human at every point. So when the divine is overcoming the human at every point, only the divine is left over, and you have again the oneness of being. So again you can see how in a statement like this you have a sense of divine science coupled with a sense of absolute Christian science and Christian science, but it always shows that the source, the authority from where the Christ takes its power is somewhere embedded in the oneness of being and exemplifies itself into the outside by bringing forth phenomena of the level of absolute Christian science or Christian science, either as bringing forth the right idea or by showing that the right idea overcomes a illusion. For instance, we have in the text here and there these two aspects of the Christ, that aspect of the Christ which is typical for the structure book, for the structure matrix. You know what I mean by the structure matrix, the matrix we have of the structure of the Christian Science textbook. And then there are again statements that are very typical for the oneness matrix we are making now. Listen, for instance, this. She says, this Christ, or divinity of the man Jesus, was his divine nature. Christ is his divine nature, you see. The godliness which animated him. Can you hear? It's all in the same nature. It all happens within the same level of divine science. On the godliness of it, on the divine nature of it, nothing else is taken in as the Christ. But not far away from this statement, we have another statement about the Christ, where she says, the divinity of the Christ is made manifest in the humanity of Jesus. Can you see how the text in the textbook is constantly interweaving into the structure, into the whole story of Atonement and Eucharist, always somehow the source from which it draws its authority, namely the oneness of being, divine science, the Christ, the godliness which animated Jesus. So, I point that out so that when you are reading the text of a chapter, you are aware that Mrs. Eddy would constantly change the dimension on which she is speaking, the level on which she is speaking. She constantly changes, so to say, the key of her melody, and goes from one key to the next key, because only in this way she can bring out the infinite translatability of a divine idea so that it has become practical and adapted to the human situation. Let's look at the scriptural note and see how there she has intertwined into the scriptural notes the tone of divine signs. There is that statement from Paul where she says, "And they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts." Now, see, she doesn't say, "And they that are Christ's crucify the flesh with the affection and lusts." Here she says, "have crucified." Have crucified. See, this lifts at once the whole tone onto the level of divine science, and say, those that are in Christ, they are actually free from the flesh and their affections. It is excluded. It's already crucified. There is no process of crucifying and of drinking the cup, which is actually the main subject in the chapter. The chapter Atonement and Eucharist is all about the Eucharist. It's all about how to lay down the mortal, how to drink the cup, how to eat the bread, how to crucify the flesh. You see, it's all about that when you are thinking in the textbook structure. Really, I should have a convention of terminology among the in this class. Let's put it down. What shall we call it? You know, what I'm doing, I'm constantly comparing the matrix of the textbook structure as given in my book, The Structure of the Christian Science Textbook. I'm comparing that with what we are doing now. So let's say we call that the textbook matrix, when we consider the textbook as a consistent story running right through the textbook matrix. So when I speak about the textbook matrix, I mean the matrix that we have in the book on the structure of the Christian Science textbook, Our Way of Life. Textbook matrix. So I make also a mental note. And when we speak about what we are doing this week, about the matrix of oneness which we want to build up from the text, let's call that the oneness matrix. So perhaps now we will always understand each other. All right. So, let's see. The text here, the biblical note that I have read, is now showing the tonality of the level of divine science, therefore is a key tone for the oneness matrix, whereas the textbook matrix, would now say, well, and they that are Christ's have to crucify the flesh with their affections and lusts, because it would be a process of laying down the false concept. Here it is a much higher sense, which is here brought out. When she speaks about that we have crucified the flesh with affection and lusts, she gives here a sense that actually that when we are in Christ, we are sinless, because then there is no more sin to be overcome. And when one looks up in Mrs. Eddy's writings, which is quite interesting to see, what does she mean by sin? What is actually her concept of sin, you know, because the concept of sin has constantly changed during the few thousand years of spiritual development. For instance, in the Old Testament, sin was just missing the mark, which meant that we fail to live up to the divine standard. Failing to live up to the divine standard, that was, so to say, the Old Testament sense of sin. Whereas the New Testament sense of sin was again quite different. When one was asking Paul what he meant by sin, he always said that whatever is not of faith is sin. Whatever is not of faith, well, he had a sense of faith that was spiritual understanding. It wasn't blind belief. So he felt whatever is not of our understanding of God is sin, much higher sense of it. And Mrs. Eddy gives in Unity of God quite an interesting definition. It's in Unity of God on page 54-15, where she says, the at-one-ment or oneness with God is a unity which sin recognizes as its most potent and deadly enemy. So here she would indicate that sin is what? That she would say what, that it is the counterfeit of oneness with God. That oneness with God is the most deadly weapon for sin, or enemy for sin. So when we consider it here, we really can see that she would say those that are Christ's are actually without sin. They have overcome sin, they are without sin, and therefore give us a sense of that sin does not need to be overcome.